hopefully it'll be a leisurely pace, because I'm just going to give you the basics. You could give a whole lecture course on Bell's theorem, but we're not going to do that. So this is a result due to John Bell from 1964. You can think of it as the next important event relative to the lecture we had on early work on locality. And since then, there's been, I think, I heard recently that Bell's paper might be one of the most cited papers in physics, possibly the most cited paper. I can't remember exactly how many citations it has. But there's lots of activity in this field still today, and lots of debate as to what the significance of Bell's theorem is. So what I thought I would do is, instead of launching into a mathematical proof of Bell's theorem, I think the best way to understand it is to start with an intuitive proof, okay, with as little math as possible, so that you can really wrap your head intuitively around what's going on. So we're going to look at a scenario where there are two measurements. And I'm not going to tell you what they are in quantum mechanics, because Bell's theorem is a statement about theories. It's not a statement about quantum mechanics. It's a statement that says, if your theory is local in a particular sense, then there's only certain kinds of correlations it can generate. So we're just going to imagine two measurements thought of operationally, right? They're just black boxes. They come in two types, and they're each two outcome measurements. So I'll just represent that as there's either a green or a red LED light that comes on if you measure the S measurement, and same if you measure the T measurement. And the setup is that you have some preparation procedure which generates, which has sort of two output ports, and you can think of this as two systems flying off. One system flies off to the left, one system flies off to the right, and they get measured according to these operations. And what measurement occurs at a given wing is decided uniformly at random. So there's just
both the S's.
So in one of the scenarios, say you flip a coin on each side and they both come up heads, then you would measure S on both sides. But you could also end up measuring S and T, because the coin flip comes up tails over there, or T and S, or T and T. So those are the four things that happen, and they each happen equally frequently. Right. Okay. So instead of launching into what are the funny correlations, we'll start with some less funny correlations to get our intuitions going. And so this, I always like to make this a challenge to the audience to get the correlations right. It also makes it more fun. So we're gonna act out this experiment. So what I'm going to need are two trusted individuals to serve as my measurement apparatus. So I guess we should have authority figures for that. So Tibro and Michael, can I ask for your help as well? All right. So as a reward for participation, you have a chance of winning money. So here's your loonie. You can stand over at that end. Okay. So if
I figured I shouldn't pocket this yet.
Not yet, but you may be able to. So let me issue you each your equipment. There you go. Okay. That's like your data register. Good. And now, I'm going to need two students to act as the particles. So you're the ones who are going to have to generate the correlations. You're the ones who are going to be faced with the challenge. And if you get it right, you each win a loonie. So who's daring enough to volunteer? All right, Kyle? It's very easy. It'll be the easiest dollar you've ever won. All right. Excellent. Thank you. Okay, so here's your challenge. So as we know, there's these two possible measurements. And Michael and Tibro are going to flip their coins to determine which measurement is being made on you. And then they're just going to jot down an S or a T on the piece of paper. Heads, it's S. T, it's tails. And then your tasks, you're allowed to confer ahead of time on a strategy. Yeah, that's right. Not to be confused with the caribou head, which is also a tail. So what's going to happen is you win the game if you can fulfill these correlations. So whenever the same measurement is made on both of you, you're the particles. Say you're B, you're over there. Chris, you'll be A, going over there. Whenever the same measurement is made, your outcomes should agree. So basically, you have to come prepared to answer green or red to the S and the T question. And you should be prepared to answer in such a way that if you both get asked S or both get asked T, then your answer should agree. And if different measurements are made on you, then your outcomes should always disagree. So, is that, should I?
Ask us S or T.
That's right.
And I'm going to have to say green or red.
Exactly. That's it. And you're not going to know what the other person's being asked. That's the trick.
S is heads.
S is heads for you guys. T is tails. So take a moment, confer on what your strategy is going to be. Meanwhile, I think everybody should be asking themselves, how do you win this game? You should actually, to simulate the ultimate Bell experiment, that what you really want to do is flip your coins after they finish conferring and are flying toward the such that the information about what your coin flip was won't get to them. Yeah. Are you guys ready? So you're going to write your answers on these cards without, and we're going to be watching these so that you're not communicating or signaling to one another what question you're being asked. And then I'll collect the data and see if you win or not. All right? Go. That's being silence. And you can just write the answer on the card. So pass the card to the particle. Yeah. The cheaper, you have to.
Or just choose. Right, but I have to know whether it's
expertise
that's being measured.
Did you get an answer?
These are
all right,
really good.
I'll collect
it down. You don't know how to play games. So.
What does that say?
Yes, is
that the green outcome? Yes is green?
No.
No, you.
I just said red.
Red. Oh, okay.
Red.
I heard yes.
There are such things as imperfect detectors. Yeah. We'll come to that. All right. And so here, you got a red. And what was your question?
My answer.
Your answer was T. Okay. So the situation is you're both asked T, and you both answered red, and the rule was that if you both get asked the same questions, your answer should agree, so you win the money. Well done. Now you have to hand over the cash. Good, and you can sit down, thank you. How is it? Okay, so very straightforward, very easy. Let me ask, what was your strategy?
If we were asked S, you would say green. If we were asked T, you would say red.
Okay. So that's exactly the strategy I have here. Right. So here's the rules of the game. If they get asked the same, their outcome should agree. So T, T, or S. If they get asked different, their outcome should disagree. And so this strategy, where they always answer green for S and red for T, will give you disagreement along the diagonals, agreement along the horizontals, and it'll always work, no matter which of the four questions are asked. This strategy will win. There's another strategy that'll do it, which is red for S and green for T. Okay. Second scenario. So I won't act this one out, but there's still a dollar at stake for anyone who can tell me a strategy that wins this game all the time. So it's the same setup, except now, whenever the same measurement is made on the two particles, the outcomes will always disagree. And whenever different measurements are made on the two particles, the outcomes should always agree. So give it some thought. And you've already won a dollar, so I'm going to have to pass. Yes?
You have the same strategy for one particle and flip red and green for the other one?
Exactly. So here's your dollar. This is always the most expensive lecture. So this is the scenario you want to set up. On the diagonals now, you want to have agreement. On the horizontals, you want to have disagreement. So if you just do the green, red here, and you flip the outcomes over there, you always succeed. That's easy. OK, this is the interesting one now. There's $2 in it for whoever can either generate these correlations or explain why it is not possible to do it. So the scenario is whenever the measurement T is made on both the particles, then the outcome should disagree. Otherwise, so for the other three scenarios, the outcomes have to agree.
Question?
Yes.
Do we require certainty?
To win the game, so what's going to happen is, you know, one quarter of the time, this is going to be measured, one quarter of this, this, and this. And you'd like to maximize your probability of winning the game.
Okay.
And the question is, can you always win the game? You know, can in every run, regardless of what measurement comes up, can you have a strategy that will win that game? But you've already won $1. hang on to that thought.
Just explain why it doesn't work?
Yeah, if you can explain to me why you can't win the game, then you could win the $2. Do you want to give it a shot?
Let's assume that the two particles do not know what the other particle is asked for.
That's right.
Then in that case, each particle will have to answer the same on the question T, and for example, if it's yes or no question, each particle will have to answer yes on the T question, and would have to answer no on the yes question.
But why is that?
For the disagreement on S and T.
S and T should, your outcome should agree with S and T.
For the disagreement on, I mean,
you got it backwards. You got it backwards.
Okay. So then they would have to give the same answer on S and T.
Yes.
But they would have to give different answers on T and T.
Right.
So now let's take two of the examples and then we get a contradiction.
Okay.
So if you take, for example, S and T, then they will give the same answer. S and S, they will give the same answer. T and T, they should give the same answer because S and S is the same, S and T is the same, but T and T cannot be the same. T and T must be the same for that argument.
Well, I think there's one, you're basically there, but I think there's one step that you've failed to say, which is, so if S and S are the same, and S and T are the same, then these guys are the same. But now you also need to use the fact that T and S are the same,
yes,
such that you can get the fact that T and T have to be the same.
I assume they're indistinguishable, so T and S and S and T are the same. S and T is the same as equal to T and S.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, that's good enough for me. There you go.
I think we have found a way to motivate the SAI students.
Yeah. That always works. So if I can run through your proof again with a visual aid, here's the reason you can't win the game 100% of the time. So this is the pattern of correlations you're supposed to generate. If it's S and S, it's agreement, T and S agreement, S and T agreement, but disagreement here. Now, over here, you have to give some outcome, either red or green. So without loss of generality, let's assume you give the green outcome for that guy. Same argument can be run if you give the red outcome. Now, by virtue of this diagonal, you know that this outcome has to be green. By virtue of the horizontal, you know that that outcome has to be green. And again, this diagonal tells you this has to be green. And now you're not fulfilling the disagreement here. So in order to satisfy those three rules, you can't satisfy the fourth rule. And if you started, as I say, with some other color, you would have gotten the same contradiction. And so, question, what's the highest probability with which you can win this game out of all strategies you might apply?
Resist the temptation.
Okay.
Does anybody else have thoughts on or an explanation of why the maximum probability is what you think it is?
Well, there's basically there's four strategies, four scenarios here, and I think it'd be a trade-off between whether we can get three scenarios right and one wrong, or
Okay, why is that?
Well, assuming that the two.
Well, you're looking for an upper bound, so.
Yeah. I'm saying the upper bound is at least
75%.
I'm saying the upper bound is at least 75%.
Okay.
So, I'm not sure that that's, that is the upper bound, but I think that is at least that, because assuming that the two measurements are made at equal probability, if you just say you always get green, then if you measure three out of four times, you're going to get that it degrees.
Right.
And so that's at least 75%. The question is, can you get better than that?
Can you get better, yeah. Anybody have any ideas on whether you can do better? Cheat? We're going to get to that, but it's not cheat for the moment.
There is one thing you can do, which is that when it's S, you always say.
Okay.
And then it's T, you say green with probability T.
Okay.
And then if P equals 0, you get 50%. If T equals 1, P equals 1, you get 50%. And if P equals a half, you get 50%. So it always is 75%.
But I don't think you've covered all possible strategies there. You've said sort of, you know, one particularly interesting strategy still gives you only 75%. Like, I don't consider that a proof that there isn't some other strategy that will do better. So I'm still waiting to hear. I'm still waiting to hear a proof. Are you all stumped? Well, let me give you a hint. You can enumerate all possible strategies. So the only thing that a particle needs to be prepared for, it needs to be prepared to give answers to four possible sets of questions. So it knows that it's either going to have S or T asked, and it has to give, you know, a red or a green answer. So just think of that as a 0 or a 1. So it has to have a 0 or a 1 prepared for the S question and a 0 or 1 prepared for the T question. So its answers could be, you know, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Those are the only four instructions it can come with. You know, I'm talking about the deterministic strategies. So it could have those four strategies. The other particle could have the same four strategies. So there's 4 times 4, 16 possible ways they could be answering questions. And that's it. There's only these 16 deterministic possibilities. They could choose randomly among those, but there's only 16 possibilities.
And choosing randomly amongst the deterministic probabilities should never give you a higher probability, because you're still, at the end of the day, choosing one of those answers that has a probability that you can enumerate explicitly by looking at all four possible cases and what that strategy would give you in those four cases.
Yes. So if you write down, you know, strategy one, particle one is going to answer green, green. Particle two is going to answer green, green. Then you say, how often, you know, given that there's equally likely to be asked these four questions, how often do they win? And there the answer is 3/4 of the time. Then you write down the next strategy. You know, a particle one is going to answer green, green. Particle two is going to answer green, red. Okay, so that's a different pattern. And then you go through it and you say, okay, if the green's here and red's here, okay, well then you do have disagreement, but you fail here. So again, 3/4 of the time you succeed, 1/4 of the time you fail. So probability is again 3/4. If you get to another one like green, red, green, red, then you satisfy the two horizontals. Sorry, no, you don't satisfy the bottom one, and you don't satisfy either diagonal, so you only win 1/4 of the time. So some of those strategies are worse. You don't win 3/4 of the time. And if you randomly implemented one of those strategies, if you know, you tossed a coin to decide whether you're going to implement strategy 3 or 2, then some of the time you'd win less frequently. So the point is that the deterministic strategies win at most 3/4 of the time. You can probabilistically weight among the winning strategies, the optimal winning strategies. That doesn't change your probability of winning. But there's no way to get above 3/4. So is that crystal clear or not? Because I think this intuitive way of seeing the proof is really the way to wrap your head around Bell's theorem. So is it absolutely clear, or should we go over it in more detail? It's not clear? It is clear. OK. Good. All right, so here is a set of correlations wherein, at most, you can win the game 75% of the time by local strategies. And now the surprise is that in quantum theory, there are ways of winning this game about 85% of the time. So how do the quantum systems manage to do it? All right, well, suppose you know we acted out the first strategy. So imagine we were doing that we had, you know, very particles that could have, you know, arbitrarily complicated instruction sets, and they were going to go off to the detectors. And imagine that the particles are arbitrarily complicated. They can communicate to one another. They can do all whatever you like. So think of it in terms of Chris and Kyle. It's Kyle, right? Ross, I'm sorry. Who's Kyle? You're Kyle. I'm sorry. So how could Chris and Ross have won that game more than 75% of the time? I mean, that wasn't a very high security game. And so just in terms of that game, how could they have, if we'd played the third one, the Bell challenge, in what ways could they have cheated and won the game more than 75% of the time? Right. Yes. Yes, exactly. He could make the answer to one of his questions not just dependent on the question he's getting, but dependent on the distant question as well, if you could communicate. So that's true. So let me, I don't have an overhead for that, but let me go back to it. So here, for example, on the right, the answer, if you were able to communicate whether you had received S or T, then Chris could answer green if you've communicated that you received S, and red if you've communicated that you received T, and then all of these correlations would be satisfied. So that's good. What's the problem with that? Well, you could do this experiment wherein your two apparatuses were set up in space-like separated regions. And the time at which the measurement is chosen over here, so when the coin flip happens, is such that even if light were transmitted immediately to the other wing, it wouldn't arrive before an outcome was registered over here. And so even if the apparatuses or the particles are communicating that information, it doesn't get to the other side in time, so the other particle has to make its decision without the benefit of that information. OK, so well, So the next bit, we'll be moving into the more formal approach. So maybe I'll just say a few preparatory comments on the more formal stuff. And okay, well, or I'll just take questions. Yes.
Be using if you're going to try to talk about relativity, don't you need to be using a quantum theory that encompasses relativity? So you'd be using a field theory, quantum field theory, then to try to talk about your apparatus and the way things are working.
Well, so far, the result that the probability of winning is less than 75% is a result that has nothing to do with quantum theory. It says any theory which is local ought to be within that bound. And now when you say, well, we should analyze quantum theory relativistically, do you mean to say perhaps that 85% is an artifact of a non-relativistic calculation, and if we did a relativistic calculation, we would get 75% or less? Is that the suggestion?
Not necessarily. I'm just curious, you know, how this... Because if you're dealing with normal quantum theory, you're using Galilean relativity, which the speed of light is infinite, so then you can't talk about a problem like this. So I guess this is assuming that you just have a general, like, any theory that...
Well, let me show you how you prove that quantum mechanics can get 85%, and let me just delay answering that question until we've seen that, and then we'll look into it. Let me skip this and go straight to the quantum result. We'll come back to those slides. So here's how you can do 85% in quantum theory. Your two measurements, S and T, I'm going to represent as measurements on a plane of the Bloch sphere. So the pair of particles could be spins, and I'm measuring the spin along the z-axis of the x-axis over here. They could be photons, whose polarization I'm measuring. They could be anything, any quantum degree of freedom you like. A necessary condition for something to be genuinely quantum is that it has to have at least one two-dimensional subspace which is coherent. And so all I need to do is find some two-dimensional Hilbert space of the quantum system in which to do a pair of measurements. Okay? And that's going to be the seed of my response to your question. Yes?
All right. I don't quite understand what you're meaning with a coherent dimension. That you need to find some subspace such that there's a dimension in which. Can you say that again?
So, suppose, for example, that you were doing measurements on, a complicated five-level system, but you know some of those levels decohered. As long as there's some pair of levels that didn't decohere, you could do measurements in that two-dimensional subspace of the Hilbert space.
Okay.
Or alternatively, if you were using, say, the spatiotemporal degree of freedom of some particle, well, there's lots of measurements you can do there, but you could still also find some effective two-dimensional subspace probe. And in fact, people use this to avoid certain experimental problems. So for example, if on the two wings there's no shared notion of what's up, so you don't have correlated Cartesian reference frames, then there's a way in which you can encode quantum information in the relations between three spin a half particles. And that quantum information concerns relational degrees of freedom and is totally independent of the notion of up. So you can find a two-dimensional subspace in which to do this, even though you don't share common reference frames, for example. Okay, so on the left, S and T correspond to X and Z spin. And on the right, S and T correspond to spin along these directions. So this corresponds to spin along a X plus Z direction, and this along an X minus Z direction in space. So it's, in the case of spin, these directions correspond to the directions in space. And now, how do we see that we get 85%? Well, suppose that they both get asked S, right? So now, think of those two lines there. Let me do this on the board. The quantum state that I'm imagining you start with is 1 over root 2, 0 on A, 0 on B, plus 1 on A, 1 on B. OK, and now I'm going to measure
Suppose I measure along some basis, plus along the n-hat direction, minus along the n-hat direction, where this n is part of the span of x and z. OK, well, in that case, the coefficients are real. So I have a0 plus b0, the b1, where a and b depend on the particular direction. But if it's in the xz plane, then a and b are real coefficients. So for x eigenstates, they're 1, 0, 0, 1. And for z eigenstates, that's what they are. For x eigenstates, they're 1 over 2, 1 over 2, and 1 over 2 minus 1 over 2. So now if I act on system, if I take this joint state, psi AB, and I take the inner product with, with the state up along the spin n direction for A, then I just have this, A0 plus B1 acting on this guy here. And I'm just left with something that's proportional to A0 on B plus B1 on B. And the proportionality constant tells me the probability that I get this outcome. The point is that if I find the plus n state on the left system, then I collapse the right-hand system to the plus n state. And if I find the minus n state on the left system, I collapse the right system to the minus n state. So we've seen things like this before. And what it means is that if I measure along this axis, and I get, say, the green outcome, then I collapse this guy over here to the north pole point on top. And if I collapse this guy to the red point, if I get the red outcome, then I collapse him to this. The right-hand side gets collapsed to this, and so on. So then you can calculate what the probability of getting, say, the S green outcome is over there, given that you got the S green outcome over here. So you get the green outcome, you collapse this guy to this state here, and then you measure along this basis. Well, from our experience with the Bloch sphere, the overlap between that state and this state gives me the probability of getting that outcome. It's just the cosine of the angle in the Bloch sphere over 2 squared. And so it's cos theta over 2 all squared. And in this case, theta is pi by 4, right? Because they're separated by pi by 4. And so it's just cos squared of pi by 8, which is 1 half plus 1 over 2 root 2, which is about 0.85. So that's what I get if I have the green outcome here. That's the probability I get the green outcome there, which is the probability I have agreement. And if I got the red outcome for S, and I look, what's the probability of getting the red outcome for S given that I've collapsed here? Again, it's only separated by pi by 4, so it's 85%. And so you can go through and you can say, well, what if I had S on the left and T on the right? So S green is separated by 45 degrees from T green, so 85% agreement there. If I do T on the left and S on the right, then T green is separated from S green again by pi by 4, 85%. And then finally, in this case, here's the nice bit. If I have measured green over there and I collapse to the North Pole, now I have the opposite kind of correlation. So I've collapsed to the North Pole, and if I ask what's the probability of getting agreement, the green outcome again, it's now not pi by 4 away, but 3 pi by 4 away. And so the probability of getting agreement is now 15%, and the probability of disagreement is 85%. So down here, you get an 85% probability of disagreement. So in all four cases, your probability of disagreement is 85%. So on average, it's 85%. Yes?
Some sort of like super quantum systems that you can get better than 85% with?
As far as we know, there don't exist such things in nature. But one of the really interesting avenues of research and foundations in the last few years has been to study theories which are different from quantum mechanics. I like to call them foil theories because people study them not because they think they're accurate theories of the world, but as foils, as you know, ways the world might have been but isn't. And when you explore those theories, they can teach you things about the theory we really have by saying, oh, well, if you change the theory, then certain things would be the same as our world, other things would be different. And so we learn something about the interconnection of the phenomena that we actually see. In fact, in general, that's true. If you want to know something about two phenomena, you want to say, are these two phenomena necessarily co-occurrent? Then the most sense you can make of that question is, if I look at a landscape of different possible theories, is it the case that in all the theories where one phenomena occurs, the other phenomena occurs as well? So studying these foil theories helps you figure out what the connections are. And people have looked at something called PR boxes. So there's a famous paper by Popescu and Rohrlich from the 90s, I think, where they ask the question, are there correlations that are non-signaling but still don't violate Bell inequalities? And aren't the quantum correlations. They were in the beginning, they thought, well, perhaps if we impose the you can't signal constraint, and they would find that quantum correlations are the strongest correlations you can have. But then they came up with this precise example that I'm telling you about. So this proof of Bell's theorem I'm giving you is based on the Popescu-Rohrlich example. So it's clear here that you could imagine winning the game 100% of the time. That could be a possible theory. And so they said, well, quantum theory is not as non-local as it could be. It could be more non-local. And in the last few years, people have been starting to come up with physical principles that rule out those theories. And they're coming up with principles that pick out the precise set of quantum correlations. So it's sort of exciting. You know, for a long time, we worried about how can we make sure that there's more non-locality relative to these classical local theories. You know, what sorts of assumptions would you have to make to get non-locality? And now people are coming at it from the opposite way and saying, what sort of assumptions do you need to make to get less non-locality so that you get precisely the quantum amount and not more? Good question. Yes?
Are these the axiomatization
program? Yeah, I would say that's a big part of the axiomatization program. It's done from an operational perspective. It says, if you had black boxes that could win this game 100% of the time, what sort of information processing tasks could you do better? So people have shown, for instance, communication and complexity problems are simplified if you have these sorts of tasks. They become certain ones and become trivial. So it's typically principles about your capability to do various information processing tasks. Recently, it was shown, actually, that if you did have a theory of these PR boxes, the reversible dynamics in such a theory ends up being trivial. And therefore, they're computationally less powerful than quantum theory. So there's something about the fact that the symmetries in quantum theory are much form a much larger set than the symmetries in these kinds of theories. These kinds of theories would be computationally quite trivial. Yes?
The boxes that win 100% of the time are those non-local boxes?
They're also called non-local boxes. Like PR boxes or non-local boxes are the two terms that people use.
Oh, okay. They're not the same.
And when they use the term box, they're really sort of imagining all of this is put into a box. And you think of it as a box that has an input and an output on one side and an input and an output on the other side, and it behaves in precisely this fashion. Like your input is an S or a T, your output is a red or a green, and it generates these correlations. So yeah, there's a lot of work to be done on PR boxes, and if you look on Quant PH Archive for papers and foundations, you'll see that people are thinking a lot about these things today. This is the proof that in quantum theory you can get 85%. Now let me set aside a worry that you probably don't have, but which is important. Could you potentially signal using these kinds of effects? Could you send signals faster than the speed of light? You can't, and here's the proof. So remember, this is the setup. Imagine you did some arbitrary measurement over here. In quantum theory, that's described by some POVM. And you do some arbitrary measurement over there, described by some other POVM. And your preparation is described by some bipartite density operator. And you want to know, what are the probabilities for the different outcomes, J? And do they depend on what choice of measurement I've made over here? Because if they did, I could use that to signal. So for example, I could choose one measurement. And you know, you would take a lot of statistics while I'm doing this measurement. And then I change my measurement, and you take a lot of statistics. And then whether you get one set of statistics or another will tell you whether I'm sending you a 0 or a 1. So we have to calculate. What's the probability of outcome j? Well, it's just the sum over k of the probability of getting k over here and j over there. And that's just this expression, the trace over ab of the tensor product of these effects times the density operator, summed over k. But now I can bring this sum inside. And this is a POVM, so the element sum to identity. So this is just identity tensor f, j. And regardless of what this POVM was, it'll always sum to identity. So this expression has no dependence on what the nature of the POVM you measured over here was. It gives the same statistics for all POVMs over here. So the statistics on the right are completely independent of what's done on the left. And how did we get this? Well, the key assumption was that these POVMs commute with one another. It's really a tensor product. And that's essentially an assumption we make, that if you're in space-like separated regions, then the operators you use to model your measurements must commute by virtue of being space-like separated. So we've really built this into quantum theory by demanding that. OK, so this is called no signaling, or maybe better to say no superluminal signaling. Quantum theory does not allow superluminal signaling. And as I was saying earlier, you can imagine PR boxes which generate win this game 100% of the time. And you can prove that there's a way of generating the outcomes such that you still can't signal with those PR boxes. So quantum theory allows you to win 85% of the time without signaling. And there's a way of winning it 100% of the time without signaling as well. Do you have a question?
Yeah, so the restrictions from special relativity come is imposed by imposing that they commute.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So getting back to the question of, you know, was this a non-relativistic calculation? Ultimately, all that's important is that you find some degrees of freedom wherein you can have a two-dimensional Hilbert space correlated, entangled with the two-dimensional Hilbert space over there. If you use the spin degree of freedom, the relativistic treatments and the non-relativistic treatments are essentially the same. But if you like, you could use, you know, quantum fields and do measurements on your quantum fields. That will work just as well. Relativistic field theory also concerns Hilbert spaces, tensor products of Hilbert spaces. So you haven't really assumed anything that's particular to non-relativistic quantum mechanics. OK. Rather than getting formal, let's talk about a few questions. So question, would access to randomness help to generate these correlations, the greater than 75% correlations? So we've been talking essentially about deterministic strategies. What about objective indeterminism? Did the proof of Bell's theorem rely on an assumption of determinism? Why not?
Because we said that any strategy that we chose that wasn't deterministic couldn't be better than a deterministic strategy, because ultimately in each case, no matter how you arrived at a decision, you arrived at a decision to say something.
Right.
And that had a problem.
Right. Another way to think about it, but that's absolutely a great way to think about it. One way I like to think about it is that if the two of you had dice or you know, some random number generator, it wouldn't have helped you win the third game any better. But you could have gone off to the questions and then, you know, used your random number generator to randomize your outcome. But your problem was generating stronger correlations, not weaker correlations. Any extra randomness you go will degrade the amount of correlation you get between the two sides, not increase it. And furthermore, any randomness over here at the detector is no different from randomness prior to get it flying apart, right? So if you were going to flip coins, you might as well just do it early, flip the coins, keep the coins, go over to the devices, and then use those coin flips to respond appropriately. So we'd already actually taken into account the possibility of randomness at the detectors by taking into account the possibility that you could choose the probability distribution over the 16 possible strategies that you use. Okay, so determinism is not an assumption of Bell's theorem. Next question, is the proof robust to experimental imperfections? For example, the detector sometimes failing to register an outcome. Okay, so suppose you're in the lab, you're doing Bell inequality tests, and your detectors sometimes just don't give you any outcome at all. Does that cause a problem? Let me ask Aaron on this one. Yes, go ahead.
I don't know much about it, but intuitively it seems like there should be a noise limit. Like if you're, if your detector is only failed, like 0.0001% of the time, it's clearly not going to hurt you when like the violations you're looking for are on the order, like probability differences of like 0.1, 0.2. So like, but if they fail, for example, 50% of the time, it seems like you may have a problem.
Right. Exactly. So if they're slightly imperfect, say they fail 1/1000th of the time, then you if you did the experiment and you still found a winning probability that was higher than 75%. So out of all cases, right, so consider the cases where one of the detectors doesn't respond as a loss. So we can imagine Ross and Chris sometimes decide just not to give any answer, and that's considered a loss. They could still end up winning more than 75% of the time if their loss rate is sufficiently low. And we'd still be surprised by it, that there would be no explanation of that greater than 75% win rate. So exactly, the Bell inequality may still be violated, even if you have experimental imperfections. But as you say, if the detector inefficiencies are sufficiently high, there ought to be a way for particles that do obey local causality to simulate the correlations. Yes?
Use larger quantum states than use an aircraft.
Well, there's various types of imperfection, and one of them would be noise on the quantum systems. And you're right, if you're using an aircraft encode, you could compensate for that noise. But at the end of the day, you still have some measurement that's made, and you can imagine that you have an inefficiency which tells you that only some fraction of time you actually get an outcome at all. And typically these experiments are done with photons, and so you're working with photodetectors that often don't find the photon at all.
Right, but you can do the same kind of idea with measurement and set a flagged error on measurement, so that if you get no result, you can up to a limited number. Mm-hmm. I don't know, partner mentor, how do you do it? Can you use error correction to make a measurement such that it's, if it fails, you get to try again by using redundancy in your code?
Perhaps you could. Let me put it this way. I mean, you're answering a question of, how can you design an experiment such that, given realistic detector efficiencies, you still manage to conclusively prove Bell inequality violation? And that is a whole field of work. There are people who try to reduce the demands on detectors. And so I think that's a good idea, and you should run with that. It might be hard to implement error correcting codes experimentally. But what I'm really looking for here is sort of a notion of how could particles which were actually using local instructions make use of that efficiency to win more than 75% of the time, or to fear efficiency.
If the detector is not correlated with the particles,
mm-hmm.
like if the inefficiency of the detector are completely unrelated to the particles, it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't change. Shouldn't help the particles break the
That's right. If there's something called the fair sampling assumption, which says that if the photons that are detected are a fair sample of all the photons that were created, so there's nothing special about the ones that were detected, then it shouldn't matter that you've lost a bunch of them. But skeptics who, you know, think that it's important to sort of seal every loophole that could possibly explain these correlations with a local theory would say, ah, but you know, maybe the fair sampling assumption is wrong. Eric?
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing.
But that maybe the fair sampling assumption is wrong.
No. Yeah. It's like what? Yeah, what he said.
Okay. So the only thing that should be added is that you know the way that particles can make use of this is as follows. That say they're prepared to answer you know green to all questions, and so they know in that case if we both get asked T, we're in trouble. And so now let's say they go up to the detectors and they find T, then they can say ah. In this case, I will not generate an outcome because this is the one where I'm, you know, I risk not generating the right correlations. Whereas if they get asked something else, they say, oh, I'm prepared for these correlations. I'll generate an outcome. So if the particles could somehow influence when the detector was inefficient, then clearly it could get its rate of winning on the cases where you did get detections higher. Okay. So this is called the detector loophole. And so far, so it has been sealed. There's been one experiment done, well, probably more. But the first experiment to seal the detector loophole was in Boulder, Colorado, with beryllium ions in a trap. So we know that you can seal this loophole. But now there's a second kind of problem that will arise. Hang on a sec. Is there a problem if the choice of measurement is made before the particles are sent to the detectors? What about that case? So suppose in your experiment, even before the particles are headed off to the detectors, it's already decided what measurement is going to be made on them. Are you going to speak to this question? Are you still in the detector loophole? Yes?
An experimenter could easily notice that whenever a detector is set to T, nothing, like, there's a strong correlation between the detector settings and the detector failures.
Ah, well, I'm imagining that these particles would use a random set. So as you said earlier, there are many strategies that will generate the correlation. So sometimes they'll answer all green, sometimes they'll answer all red, sometimes it'll be green, 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 red, and all of those, there's a different choice of measurement for which they will fail.
So each pair of particles will make their own decision about when to fail.
Yes.
And, okay.
Exactly. There's a question over here.
Yeah.
Yes.
But this is really a technical problem.
This is a technical problem. Yes.
Measure the inefficiency of the detector.
True.
Get it and make sure it's below the threshold. No,
that's above. The efficiency should be above.
Efficiency
the
should be above.
Yeah.
The threshold. That's not possible the way the experiments were originally done.
That's right. The detector efficiencies were too low to seal the detector loophole in the original experiments. And so now we have some experiments that do seal it. But there's something that we still haven't done, which I'm coming to. So any ideas on how this might be problematic? Yes?
Isn't that going back to our determinant? Oh, if the choice are we
so
that
say the coin flip, for example,
are not aware of that.
That's well. So I'm just saying. Suppose we did the experiment in the following way. You know, I have pairs of particles I create. You know, often the experiment is done with parametric down conversion. I have a two photon state. I send it off to two detectors, and they get measured along, say, along different polarization axes. So now the question is, well, should I be worried by the fact that which axis of polarization I measure is chosen early, maybe even before the pair of particles has been created?
So this is the case where the coin flipper doesn't trust his ability to flip the coin, so he does it before.
He does it what?
Early.
Does it?
He doesn't trust his ability to flip the coin without dropping it on the floor.
So. Yeah, for example. Yeah, exactly. Yes, this is the case of the the assistants who are overeager to flip the coins before they get. Volunteers are in flight. Yes.
So if you want to put the problem in colorful language, you could say that if you're the kind of person who's prone to conspiracy theories, you could imagine that your detectors, you know, of course, are made of electrons and things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you set the detectors too early before you let the predators go, the electrons in the detectors could send a message at the speed of light to their compatriots in the down converter and tell them what strategy to use.
Exactly.
But you have to believe in this. So, like, all.
So, that's right. Yeah. That's exactly what the skeptics will say. That if you really believe in local causality, then you better not set the detectors early because there's a mechanism. It might be a bit mysterious. You know, we don't know of any communication that happens among the detectors. But relativity does not prohibit it. And so, there's a mechanism by which these particles could find out what the other choice of measurement is and use it to their advantage and simulate these correlations despite being completely local. That's called the locality loophole. So that's also been sealed in an experiment that was done in Innsbruck with photons, and the choices of which measurement were made after the particles had left, and basically in space-like separated regions. So this is enforcing the idea that these measurement choices were really made space-like separated from one another. And just a moment, the point that I want to make is that in the state of the art today is we've sealed this in one experiment, we sealed this in another experiment. There's no experiment that sealed the two of them simultaneously. And so there's still a haven for the diehard local realists. And there are some people out there who say you won't be able to seal them simultaneously. There was a question here first, and then I'll come to you.
Is it possible to make it to seal that loophole even if you choose early by saying that, well, they have to wait to tell their compatriot electrons or whatever until the electrons have actually been created, and so by making the common point that the two particles leave from.
I don't think it's important that they have to have been created already, because in these skeptical games, I'm sort of allowed to imagine any rules I want. So basically, the way this sort of game works is, you know, is there any way at all that one could salvage locality? Yes, I can imagine that some mysterious signal leaves from the detector setting and informs the device, you know, the area of space where the particles are being generated, what those detectors are, such that when the particles are generated, they already know what's going to be measured on them, and so they can be prepared. Yes?
Is there anyone so skeptical as to say that these choices are actually made by pseudo-random number generators, which are actually deterministic and programmed in advance?
Probably. It wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, there are people who have... I mean, you can be very skeptical, and you can say, ultimately, if you believe in determinism, then those settings are determined by events in a backward light curve. Even if the settings are made by pseudorandom number generators, they're ultimately fully determined. And even if they're made by individuals trying to exercise their free will, ultimately that's also determined by things in the backward light curve. And they might argue that if you go far enough back in time, everything is causally connected, such that the particles could know ahead of time what those settings are going to be, in principle, in a deterministic theory. This is called the superdeterminism way out of Bell's. Now, I think maybe we should wrap up. I mean, we can keep talking about this next time. So yeah, maybe let's just end there, and then we can continue next time with the discussion. All right.
I can think of, I think, at least one paper